From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Donald Trump headed to Vietnam on Monday for high-level talks with North Korea's leadership and a one-on-one meeting with Kim Jong-un. It will be the second meeting between the two leaders. After the first meeting, U.S. representatives said they expected North Korea to begin denuclearizing, but that has not yet happened, and the White House is now lowering expectations for the outcome of this second summit. Trump said to a group of U.S. governors on Sunday, "We have a special feeling. I think it's going to lead to something good, but maybe not." He also said that he would not be pressuring North Korea to give up its weapons immediately, saying, quote, "I'm not in a rush. I don't want to rush anybody. I just don't want testing. As long as there's no testing, we're happy." We turn to John Pfeffer, co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and a Tom Dispatch regular. He's an expert on U.S.-North Korea relations and has been on our program before. Welcome back, John.
Thanks for having me back on the show.
So what were the goalposts for both the first summit and this second summit so we can get a sense of what it is that Trump is trying to accomplish? It seems as though between the first and second summit, the goals have evolved.
Well, yes. I mean, or you could also say that there really weren't any definitive goalposts for either the first summit or this upcoming summit. I think the Trump administration was hoping to have a meeting the first time, perhaps extract some verbal promises from the North Korean leader, particularly around testing. I mean, that is a concern of the Trump administration, and the North Korean government has suspended its testing of nuclear weapons as well as all varieties of missiles. And so when Donald Trump is talking about not being in a hurry and focusing on testing, that's really what he's referring to. With this second summit, it's even less clear what Donald Trump wants exactly, though perhaps some indication that North Korea is taking at least one or two steps down the road to denuclearization or the reduction of its nuclear program.
So then it sounds as though the only real change from between the first summit and the second summit is a halt to nuclear testing.
Well, there has been, of course, some maneuvering. I mean, the United States, for instance, has scaled back on some of its exercises in the region, military exercises. And North Korea has, of course, suspended, in addition to its testing, a lot of the hostile rhetoric that it once directed towards the United States. There's also been some discussions about some economic engagement, but that's largely through South Korea. So the United States has given some exemptions, for instance, for South Korea and North Korea to explore reconnecting its train line up and down the peninsula. Beyond that, there hasn't been a whole lot to point to. But it is important to note that North Korea has shown some willingness, perhaps, to open up its Yongbyon facility to inspections, perhaps even to close it down. So that might be on the table at this second summit.
It seems as though Trump is facing tremendous pressure from Democrats and also from within his own party to take that hard line against North Korea of demanding complete and total denuclearization before the U.S. budges even an inch. Would you say that that's relatively true?
That's absolutely true, although I would say that it's not really a hardline position. That has been the official position of the U.S. government going back several administrations. In other words, that North Korea has to completely denuclearize before it sees really any significant reductions in economic sanctions, any kind of political engagement between Washington and Pyongyang. Say Secretary of State Pompeo or John Bolton, National Security Advisor. Yes, they're hardliners in general, but with respect to North Korea, they're basically just adhering to the position that the Obama administration held to as well.
So the Trump administration is trying to convince, it seems, the military establishment and the political establishment here in the U.S. that, some sort of movement on testing and maybe some sort of nuclear weapons, testing facility in being inspected should be enough to move forward. It seems as though Trump needs to convince Americans more than he does Kim Jong-un, because it seems as though Mr. Kim and Mr. Trump appear to be on the same page. They've talked about being in love with one another.
Yes, you're right that Trump has a much harder time ahead of him convincing people within his own administration, as well as the Democratic Party, which has not been enthusiastic about either of these summits or about the prospects for denuclearization. In terms of what they want, the critics are looking for something like North Korea providing an inventory of its nuclear facilities. But North Korea is probably not going to do that. As the North Korean government has said, providing an inventory like that is like providing the United States with a target list. In other words, here, come and bomb these facilities if you want to denuclearize us by force. So that's probably not going to happen. But we might see, as I said, some step forward, that's much more modest that Trump can point to. Also possibly, some kind of peace declaration, not necessarily something to replace the armistice that brought the Korean War to a close in 1953, but some kind of, say, non-aggression statement from the United States. I think the Pyongyang is definitely interested in that, and it's a relatively low-cost give by the Trump administration, and Donald Trump might be willing to do that to bolster his own case to receive a Nobel Peace Prize at some point in the future.
Right. There's been some talk of Trump's desire for a Nobel Peace Prize. There's some clear jealousy there with Obama, who was awarded the Peace Prize for talking about global denuclearization. So let's talk a little bit about South Korea, right? Because a lot of what is happening right now and what happened last year is directly the result of efforts by South Korean President Moon Jae-in, who, if anyone deserves a peace prize at the end of it all, you might imagine it could be him. What is he hoping comes out of all of this? And what role is South Korea playing in the second summit? Are they sort of on the sidelines watching and waiting, or are they in any way directly participating?
Well, Moon Jae-in, the South Korean president, has expended a tremendous amount of political capital to kind of push forward both inter-Korean reconciliation, but also rapprochement between Washington and Pyongyang, because he quite correctly understands that inter-Korean cooperation cannot proceed unless there's some kind of improvement of relations between the United States and North Korea. In other words, there's first of all a signaling process that goes on at these summits. In other words, when President Trump shakes hands with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, it sends a signal that it's okay to shake hands with North Korea, that it's okay for South Korea to pursue greater political, economic, and cultural engagement with the country. Second of all, the more ambitious projects that South Korea imagines it will construct with North Korea, such things as an economic zone similar to what existed in Kaesong, a city in North Korea, or a tourism project similar to what existed at Kumgan Mountains. All of that requires really some kind of reduction of sanctions, or at least an exemption provided to South Korea so that it can actually deal economically with North Korea. So Moon Jae-in, the South Korean president, knows that for those two reasons, the signaling and also the reduction of sanctions, he absolutely is dependent on Donald Trump, and he would prefer to be in Donald Trump's good graces. If that means deferring to the American president, if that means basically giving Donald Trump the Nobel Peace Prize, when in fact, as you point out, Moon Jae-in more richly deserves it, then the South Korean president will do that.
There is a report, there are reports that Trump and Kim may officially declare the end of the Korean War at the summit. Is that a little bit of what you were referring to earlier with what Kim wants Trump to do in declaring, an end to hostilities? And if so, why should it be the U.S. declaring an end to the Korean War instead of the two Koreas declaring an end to the Korean War?
Well, that's a very good question. To declare an end to the Korean War, in other words, to get an a replacement for the armistice with a peace treaty, that will require more than the United States and North Korea. At the very least, it will require China, which was one of the signatories. South Korea, no, yes. I mean, as you point out, it really should be North and South Korea who are declaring an end to the Korean War. But because of the way the war was declared and waged, with South Korea basically serving underneath U.S. command, technically, South Korea, their signature is not needed. However, I think for the most part, North Korea and the United States are counting on South Korea to go along. And I think Moon Jae-in government is very willing to do so. In terms of the difference between a peace treaty and a declaration of non-aggression, well, a peace treaty, if it's in fact a treaty, will require approval from the Senate. And that might be a little bit more difficult to get here in the United States. Even some members of the Republican Party might not go along with Trump on that. So I think the first step would probably be some kind of declaration and then some convening of actors in the region to discuss what a peace treaty might look like.
Let's talk about the host country, Vietnam. Vietnam is an interesting case, and Trump in recent days has said that, and the White House has said that it wants North Korea to follow the path of Vietnam and the miracle of Vietnam. And essentially, one of the things that's expected to happen is that Trump will point to Vietnam as, after the U.S.-Vietnam War, having become a global trade partner and having this vibrant economy. And if Vietnam can do that, why can't North Korea? What do you make of this?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. Of course, North Korea is also looking for some signal that the United States is willing to bury the axe with Pyongyang, as it has done with Hanoi. And so that's another kind of significant part of the story. In terms of the economic reforms, you know, North Korea has been pushed by a number of actors, China, Vietnam, to follow a more substantive economic reform path. North Korea has been somewhat reluctant, and it's been reluctant because, well, if it looks over at China, it sees that economic reform led to possibly the Tiananmen Square protests and to a real leadership crisis or governance crisis in China. And North Korea doesn't want that kind of trajectory. Vietnam is a much more appealing model because, of course, the government has managed to implement the Doi Moi economic reforms without significant political upheaval. Also, Vietnam is a much smaller country. China, of course, you know, over a billion people, represents a huge market for outside corporations, a great economic opportunity in the wake of detente of the 1970s. North Korea is only 25 million people or so, significantly fewer, not a great investment opportunity necessarily, not a huge market, much more comparable to, say, Vietnam emerging from the wreckage of the Vietnam War. So I think for those reasons, North Korea sees the Vietnam example as perhaps more applicable to its own situation. Also, I think, obviously, both the United States and North Korea are sending a signal by meeting in Vietnam that, hey, China, you cannot count completely on being involved in this, that you cannot count, for instance, on North Korean alliance completely, because of course Vietnam and China have a very difficult relationship at the moment. So I think it sends another signal to China that it has to play this game very carefully. It cannot assume that it will be the big brother in this process.
The U.S. news media is filled with warnings to Trump and the White House about dealing with Kim Jong-un, about trusting the dictatorial leader. In many ways, the two of them do have some similarities in their approaches and the size of their egos, perhaps. And it seems as though the U.S. media and a lot of political figures are convinced that Kim Jong-un is going to be manipulating Trump and has already successfully manipulated Trump. And they're warning of the dangers of the madman Kim. What do you make of this? Robert Zoellick had a piece in the former World Bank president and U.S. Trade Representative and also former Deputy Secretary of State. He had a piece in the Wall Street Journal giving Trump advice on how to negotiate with Kim Jong-un.
Well, I think there's a concern with dealing with Trump from any country that he's going to be manipulated. He's going to be manipulated because A, he doesn't know very much about foreign policy. B, he comes in without really any strategy. C, he doesn't listen to his advisors. D, he is unpredictable and one could say even untrustworthy in the sense that he changes his mind from day to day. In terms of whether Kim Jong-un is trustworthy or not, well, that's hard to say. I would point out that you can at least assume that North Korean policy is going to remain relatively constant because it's a dictatorship, and Kim Jong-un has pretty much continued the policies of his father and to a certain extent his grandfather. So there has been continuity there. We may not like the continuity, but there's been continuity. The United States, on the other hand, being a democracy, has changed its positions rather dramatically over the years. North Korea looks over at the example of Iran, for instance, and sees that the Obama administration invested a tremendous amount of political capital into getting a nuclear agreement with Iran, and the next administration turns around and cancels it. So to a certain extent, we're talking about trust between two leaders, and you know, this is something that both Kim and Trump put a lot of emphasis on, but we have a mismatch in systems in which we have continuity of policy in North Korea and we have discontinuity in policy. Perhaps we can say for good reasons, but in general, although I might disagree with it on a case-by-case basis, but a discontinuity of policy here in the United States.
I want to go back to China and what you were talking about earlier. Right before Trump left for Vietnam, the U.S.-China trade talks were wrapping up, and Trump has announced a postponement of tariffs on about $20 billion worth of Chinese goods. Some are speculating that those tariffs may never come and that the U.S. and China might be zeroing in on some sort of a deal. Trump wants to go to Mar-a-Lago and sign a deal with President Xi of China. Do those trade negotiations have a bearing on U.S.-North Korea talks?
They have an indirect bearing. Obviously, Donald Trump has seen some of the consequences of what a trade war with China would produce in terms of American farmers not being able to sell their soybeans, American manufacturers not being able to sell their products in China, as well as the potential for a real dip, not only in U.S. GDP, but global GDP. So I do think that Trump realizes that this affects not only America as a whole, but his constituency base. Now, ordinarily, I would reverse that and say a president is more concerned with the overall economy than what happens among his base. But Trump is most concerned about his base, I think, rather than the country as a whole. And he knows that his base would be adversely affected economically by a downturn in U.S.-China economic relations. In terms of North Korea, well, you know, there has been all sorts of talk over the years about how the United States should use China to help, quote unquote, solve the situation in North Korea.
And right. Trump himself has had made those claims.
Exactly. And so that's alive and well in the kind of U.S. foreign policy community here in Washington. And I think that might be, you know, contributing to his thinking on this subject. I think it's fallacious because, of course, North Korea simply doesn't listen to China, has not listened to China, except when it is in an extreme situation. So China has really limited influence. And second, China is certainly not going to simply follow U.S. orders when it comes to North Korea. It has its own kind of priorities in terms of foreign policy objectives with Pyongyang. So for those reasons, I think the China issue does kind of loom in the background, but ultimately it's not going to play an important role in these negotiations between the United States and North Korea.
Is it safe to say that if the U.S. does start to lift economic sanctions against North Korea, that China and North Korea would become far more important trading partners than the U.S. and North Korea?
Well, China and North Korea currently are, you know, really the only trading partners. I mean, North Korea doesn't have any significant trading partners outside of China. It does some trade with Russia, of course. It no longer, or at least for the time being, has much trade with South Korea. It has virtually zero with the United States. A reduction of sanctions would probably benefit not the United States, because the United States is really not poised to go in a big way in North Korea. It would help inter-Korean trade, obviously. But the only other actors who are kind of poised would be European ones, European countries who have maintained some kind of economic relationship with North Korea and who have manufacturing concerns that are ready to go in and start up as soon as the sanctions are lifted.
Going back to those claims about Kim being, you know, a dictatorial madman that Trump should worry about dealing with, it's interesting that that this summit is coming at the same time that the U.S. is essentially threatening regime change in Venezuela, calling Nicolas Maduro a madman, a dictator who is starving his people, you know, and who's not allowing aid in. Those two stories aren't really being juxtaposed, but there is some hypocrisy there, isn't there?
There's historic U.S. hypocrisy in terms of how it treats some countries and not others. Obviously, you know, seeing some dictatorial regimes as friendly regimes and other dictatorial regimes as hostile regimes. There's also the kind of hypocrisy of Trump himself, who frankly doesn't attempt to be consistent with his foreign policy positions. The bottom line is that North Korea offered an opportunity to Donald Trump because there was no pending negotiations or agreement with North Korea that had been brokered by the Obama administration. So Trump could come in and say, hey, they screwed up and we're going to solve it. Well, I should amend that. I'm going to solve it. Donald Trump, seeing his own personal negotiating abilities and charisma sufficient to affect a change in U.S.-North Korean relations. Venezuela, an entirely different situation and an entirely different, quote unquote, opportunity, if you would like to see it that way, or as the Trump administration sees it. So, yes, hypocrisy, but it will not stop the United States from pursuing kind of dual, parallel, and very different approaches to these countries.
Well, finally, John, I want to end our conversation by asking you to tell us about your one-man show. Those of our audiences in Washington, D.C. could, in early March, come and see you at the D.C. Arts Center performing your one-man piece, Next Stop North Korea. Tell us about this.
So this show basically brings audiences to North Korea. And, you know, it's not really possible for Americans to visit North Korea at the moment because of State Department warnings and prohibitions. So I thought it would be interesting to kind of bring an audience to North Korea, or as close to North Korea as you can get, without leaving your seat and for only $20. And in this show, I introduce people to different kind of people from North Korea struggling with different challenges in their lives.
But this is based on your own travels?
Yes. It's also the story of the work that I did in North Korea from 1998 to 2001. I wasn't based there, but I traveled there for a humanitarian organization. And just the challenges of what it means to engage North Korea, because it's not an easy country to work with. They are tough negotiators, and they have their own kind of perspective on how to do things. And but, you know, at the end of the day, or I should say at the end of the play, I do come down on the importance of engagement and how we can get beyond our misconceptions and our stereotypes in order to engage a country that is different from ours.
Wonderful. Well, good luck with that.
Thank you very much.
My guest is John Pfeffer, and he is the co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. He's a Tom Dispatch regular, and he's also the writer and performer of the one-man show Next Stop North Korea. We'll post a link to where you can get tickets if you happen to be in the D.C. area in early to mid-March. Our earlier discussion, of course, about the Trump-Kim summit taking place this week in Vietnam. It's the second time the two leaders will be meeting. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.